This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I am Gaius with Germanicus. We're in Londinium. It's winter time. The centurions and their families have gone home. It's dark. We're sitting with candles. We have a cup of wine and we're going to the theater. However, it entertains us to seek lessons learned from when the United States, which fancies itself an empire like the Roman Empire, it's not, but that's all right. It flatters the U.S. to think of itself that way. How do you conduct an election in wartime? And Germanicus, you've identified two elections that are fraught with example. One is 1864, Abraham Lincoln believing he was going to be defeated, believing that McClellan, the former head of the Army of the Potomac, running as a Democrat, was going to defeat him. And he wrote a letter in August of 1864 saying, as I paraphrase, as likely as it is that I will be defeated, it's necessary for the new president to become immediately into authority in order to negotiate with the Confederacy to hold together what we have, because there would be that period all the way to March that would be extremely difficult to manage without a certainty of who's in the White House. Following that, there were events, however, that made it possible to succeed. We know that Lincoln, making some important political adjustments, such as no longer being just a Republican candidate, he was a national candidate, and he brought in, he exited from Hannibal Hamlin, his vice president in the first term, a man from Maine who was solid for the Union. He brought in Andrew Johnson from Tennessee, the one member of the Senate who had remained undetermined as to what his loyalties were. And that caused problems, but not immediately. So that's 1864. You also mentioned 1916. How so, Germanicus? What do we learn from those two elections that can help us through this year, 2024, with two wars in Eurasia and a third war threatened?
With wartime elections, and there have been many, many wartime elections in American history, and I'm so stunned to see how many there have been, indeed. There are several points to keep in mind that allows one to parse and differentiate dynamics in wartime elections. One is where you have a wartime election and the country is united and it wants to see victory and it feels that victory is almost assured. That would be the election of 1944. Then there are elections where the war strategy has failed and there is a stalemate and the country wants out. It wants to extricate. That would be the election of 1952, in which horses were changed in midstream, shall we say, from Truman to Eisenhower. And then there are what I would call wartime elections, like this upcoming election, where we're not actually at war. We're not fully committed. We don't have our forces deeply embroiled in toe-to-toe bloody combat with the enemy. Rather, these are proxy war elections. And the election of 1916 was a beautiful example of a proxy war election. The president seeking re-election, Woodrow Wilson, campaigned on the banner, "He kept us out of war." And yet at the same time, the war engines of the entire Allied coalition, primarily Russia, Britain, and France, and at that point also Italy, were completely dependent on U.S. munitions production and U.S. armaments production, and equally importantly, U.S. money being loaned to keep the economies of the big three afloat. And how similar that is to the upcoming election. In other words, the U.S. president this time, Mr. Biden, has essentially all along during this war in Ukraine, repeated a similar banner to Wilson. He kept us out of war, with the slight variation of no U.S. troops have been lost. It's a bargain for 0.5% of the defense budget. We are bringing Russia down. It's a strategic victory at the price of pennies. And at the same time, we should remember that in 1916, not only were Britain, France, Russia, and Italy completely dependent on U.S. power and U.S. weapons and money, but the U.S. was but months away from being sucked into a war. And were it not for the Soviet willingness to use nuclear weapons, which you alluded to earlier, the U.S. might well have, in its arrogance and its overconfidence in its own strength, combined with the weakness of Russia, have pushed ourselves into a war, much the same way as the U.S. easily allowed itself to be sucked into World War I in the early months of 1917. So this is a situation where the U.S. is on a razor's edge in some ways. And this extends, of course, to the Middle East, where the edge is even sharper in terms of a wider Middle East war breaking out. And the problem this time, which was not the problem in 1916, is not simply the presence of nuclear weapons. It's also the fact that in 1916, the United States was 30% of all world manufacturing. We were enormously wealthy. We were big. And we were in a position to, you know, really bust things up in Europe, which we did. Today, the U.S. is a much weaker society. It's a riven society. We're at each other's throats domestically. We're perhaps 7-8% of the world manufacturing. And our weapons have failed in Ukraine in the sense that everyone expected those weapons to sweep all before them. And what we have seen is that the military power we have to wield is weak, it's fragile, and that fragility is underscored by the loss in manufacturing power. We can't produce shells as we did in World War I. We can't produce weapons as we did in World War I. We have money, but the money doesn't buy anything because we can't make anything. So the problem with 1916 was having the will to stay out. The problem today is the imminent defeat of our proxy. In other words, Britain and France were close to cracking in 1917, and Russia did crack, and Italy just about cracked, all in 1917. And the U.S. was in the war, so they didn't all collapse, except for Russia. Today, Ukraine is on the verge of collapse, and in all likelihood will collapse in the coming months. And the problem for the current emperor, Mr. Biden, is how does one get reelected when your entire strategic venture is about to fail? In 1916, the U.S. could have failed. I mean, Europe, the coalition in Europe could have failed and been defeated by Germany. But Germany wasn't close to being able to win, really, ever in World War I. And so the U.S. was in a position where it could maintain its proxy funding and at the same time then join the war in confidence. Today, we have built a proxy war and prematurely announced Ukrainian victory. And suddenly, in a stunning reversal over the course of the last 6 months, are facing a situation of absolute defeat. And this would undoubtedly, as it did in 1968 or 1952, lead to the changing horses in midstream. In other words, you'd get a new president. And so the problem for the Biden administration is how to stave off the consequences of defeat in a foreign war that is as real a war in terms of its political significance and its political weight as if it were a real war. How do you get reelected if you have a massive strategic failure on the eve of the election?
Let's take 1916. Charles Evans Hughes wasn't going to change directions. Teddy Roosevelt might have, but Hughes was not Roosevelt and was very casual about how he would conduct foreign affairs. However, in 64, as I mentioned, Lincoln thought he was going to be defeated, and he believed that McClellan would, in some fashion, surrender or negotiate with Davis, with the apparatus in Richmond. We're in a situation now where we don't have a clear understanding of the candidates. Mr. Biden says he's a candidate, and everybody believes it. Mr. Trump says he's the leading candidate, and many believe it. Trump in the White House would be a dramatic change from the Biden administration. Is that going to influence the year?
The strategic failure of Ukraine is a boon to whoever becomes the Republican candidate. Most likely now, it seems, that person is Mr. Trump.
Right.
If he is nominated and Ukraine crashes to the ground, he is on easy street, just as Eisenhower was in 53. Eisenhower was able to extricate the U.S. from Korea because that's what the country wanted, and the situation on the ground had stalemated, and there was nowhere to go. So that was pretty straightforward. If Ukraine collapses before the election and a Republican is elected, that new president can easily pick up the pieces because the war was not his problem. In fact, in 1968, Nixon was able to do that, even though he kept the war going and it ultimately came back to destroy him. But the fact is that if you're the president, the new president, who's been voted in on a promise to get out or to at least extricate, then you have no worries. The Democrats, on the other hand, in order to be able to win this election, cannot have Ukraine crash before the war, or they have to find a way to throw Ukraine under the bus, say we did all we could, Ukraine failed because they were too stuck in the old Soviet paradigm of war, they couldn't adapt to new NATO tactics, and they didn't follow our advice. Well, that may not stick because that's an obvious lie. And it's also equally obvious that we suborned Ukraine to fight this war by derailing the agreements that were almost reached in Istanbul in the spring of 2022. And so it's going to be very hard to throw Ukraine under the bus now that all of the various truths about the war are coming out so rapidly.
So is it 64 or 16 we should be watching? We have the year to go through this. We don't need to rush it. But right now, I'm attracted to the 64 model.
I am too, for the very reason that we were staring at defeat and victory was snatched at the last minute at Atlanta, Mobile Bay, and to some extent in the Shenandoah Valley. So not to mention the triumph of the Kearsarge over that devil ship, the Alabama.
Yeah.
But you have a series of fortuitous turnaround events that occurred that made Lincoln's worries in that letter suddenly unfounded.
But 65 followed, and that was a catastrophe for the nation.
It was. But the difference here, the counterpoint between 1864 and 2024 is the imminence of defeat in Ukraine,
yeah,
and the ramifications that will have, as we discussed, not just in terms of America's world position, but America's relationship with NATO, and ultimately America's capacity to preserve the state of Israel. This is a potentially a calamity of earth-shattering proportions, and it does not bode well for the Democrats, even if they have various domestic advantages that they can turn on in terms of controlling the election process. They're still going to face a situation where the country has turned against them.
That's what the polling from London says. The U.S. has lost weariness over U.S. military support. And that's not only true in the 22 states or whatever, how many there are, where there's one party in charge, Democrat or Republican. That's also true in the swing states. I've lost sympathy with Ukraine war. The reasons for that will take, about 100 years of PhDs to sort it out. Germanicus is Michael Vlahos. I am Gaius John Batchelor. We're beginning a conversation through the election year. Elections in war times, there are lessons. Right now, the lesson is that the Biden administration is faced with the genuine problem. Americans don't vote on foreign policy. We understand that. But they make decisions on the basis of victory or defeat. And the Biden administration, if I hear Germanicus correctly, is now facing a decision how to get to the election without defeat and how not to take responsibility for the Ukraine failure between now and the election day. We'll continue because we're going off to the theater. Tonight there's a pantomime of a scene from the Iliad. It's the death of Patroclus, who was Achilles' best friend. And Achilles gave him permission to put on Achilles' armor and go out to face the Trojans and scare them off the attack they had launched on the wall that the Achaeans, Greeks, had built in order to defend their ships. Patroclus put on the armor, he went out and he showed himself. And that worked initially. The Trojans ran away. Achilles is on the field. But then, and that's the part where you need interpretation, Patroclus didn't pull back. Kept going. He wanted to be Achilles, and it led to a tragedy. That's tonight at the theater. If they follow through on the promise of the bill I saw earlier, we'll, of course, sacrifice to Augustus. We are the Roman Empire, and we're critical of the American Empire because it doesn't often come up to our standards, and so we worry about it. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.